Radio Gorgeous, the place to find authors.
Elizabeth Woodcraft has had an amazing career. She worked for Women's Aid, which led her to become a barrister who worked out of the chambers of radical lawyer Michael Mansfield, QC. She represented Greenham Common peace protesters, anti-apartheid demonstrators, battered women and sexually abused children. She's now an author. She has already written two novels, but today we're talking about her third novel, Beyond the Beehive. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hello.
Lovely to have you on. So, Behind the Beehive is a story about female friendships, growing up, feminism, the mid-60s, mods, Chelmsford, and music. Backdrop of your book is music. They're always putting on the record player. They're always singing. They're always talking about music, the references of music. Is music being the backdrop to your life as well?
It pretty much has, actually, yes. I mean, from the 50s, really, when there wasn't very much to go around, but I was a big fan of Tommy Steele. And then when the mods came to prominence, which coincided with Tamla Motown music coming over from the States, with all those fabulous groups, the Supremes, the Ronettes, and all Wilson Pickett, and then the other music, Green Onions by Booker T and the MGs, it just touched a nerve. And yes, that music has pretty much stayed with me throughout my life.
Wonderful. So the book is set in Chelmsford. Is this where you grew up by any chance?
Well, it's a strange question you put there, but you've hit it right on the head. Yes, exactly. That's where I came from, Chelmsford in Essex. It was a boom town in the 50s. My mum and dad met there at one of the factories, Crompton's, and that's where I grew up, yes. And
so were they Essex people or EastEnders that have moved out?
My dad came from Heybridge Basin, which was a small village on the coast. And they were... Heybridge Basin in those days was well known for barges because a lot of goods were transported through into East Anglia by barge in the sort of late 19th, early 20th century. That's where my dad came from. But my mum came from London, from Leytonstone, but moved to Chelmsford after a bomb in the war flattened the house that she and her sisters and her mum and dad were staying in overnight, in Woodford. And her mum and dad were killed and one of her sisters,
what?
But all the others were pulled out alive, yes.
But you don't meet many people that are, you know, civilians. So it affected your family.
Oh, absolutely. Although when we were growing up, you know, it was just something we knew that had happened. We didn't have kind of strong, terrible things. You know, I mean, my mum didn't really talk about it. I mean, those things happened in the war.
How old was your mum when it happened?
She was 16. I know, I mean, but her sisters, I mean, my Auntie Rita, who's still alive, she was about 12, and my Auntie Beryl was 10.
So who looked after them?
Well, you see, they were all split up. That was the trouble. So one of the brothers who were older, one of my uncles was in the Navy and he was stationed in Faversham, so he took my Auntie Sheila and my Auntie Rita down to Faversham. My Auntie Vera, who'd been working at Foyles in Charing Cross Road, it must have been in those days, yes. Unfortunately, they weren't very good because she took some time off, as you might, after your parents had been killed and you'd been dug out of a bomb-shattered house. They sacked her because she'd taken the time off. But anyway, I think it's very different now. I think they've got a very different...
They've got rights.
Yes, well, I think Foyles have changed their modus operandi.
Yeah. But 60 years.
Yes, that's right. So anyway, Vera and my mum and then another sister, Iris, who had been living with her aunt in that house, they all moved down to Chelmsford, and then gradually all the sisters came and lived together in a flat that overlooked Chelmsford bus station, which when I was growing up was a fab place to watch Chelmsford Carnival.
Fabulous. So you say it was a boom town, so it was sort of 50s when you were sort of growing up in 60s. Mm-hmm. Was that because there was work for people?
Yes.
And it was, yeah.
It was Marconi, you know, big Marconi's factory, Hoffman's that did ball bearings. There was, as I say, Crompton's, but I think that became English Electric. And there were various other sort of factories. So it really was a big town that was expanding, and lots of things were happening.
So that mean, as you were the first ever teenagers,
exactly,
you had money in your pocket, or your parents had money to give you?
Not so much, because my dad was a trade union official, and in those days, trade union officials didn't get paid very much. So he actually, on the whole, got paid less than the men he was kind of working for.
Why?
Oh, because that was just the thing. I mean, I think, you know, there was a sense in those days that, you know, that union officials shouldn't earn more than the men. And so often that worked out that they were paid a lot less. And my mum didn't work because in those days, you know,
the wife was meant to give up work.
That's right. She stay at home. Yeah. Although, I mean, well, she did go. She went and worked sort of doing potato picking, fruit picking. She even did stone picking, which apparently is very, very hard work, where you pick stones out of fields. So we weren't terribly well off. I mean, we lived on a council estate, as did my best friend Christine, who features in the book as Sandra.
And you're Linda, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's semi-autobiographical. Some of those things in the book happened to us, but other things didn't. And obviously, you know, you've got to make things up because you've got to make it a...
You've got to make it more colourful, even more colourful.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or make it into a proper story that runs... In the right place.
Exactly, sort of. Yes, because just because things happened doesn't make them interesting or doesn't make them a story, you know. So you've got to kind of give yourself some sort of narrative arc, as they say.
So I was going to ask about the three women. So you've already mentioned, but there's one other woman who is a kind of big influence on Linda, and she is Sylvie, who's different than other women in the area. Can you tell us why?
Well, Sylvie is... older. She's probably in her mid-20s, and she has had an illegitimate child, which of course in those days was an enormous big thing, a big moral blot on the landscape. And she is shunned by many people, but Linda's family are, well, Linda's mum is very Christian and believes that you love everybody, and her dad is also strangely a trade union official and just thinks everyone should be treated equally, and so Linda doesn't have any of those views of that there's something wrong with her. But of course she's not a very happy bunny, Sylvie, because she has something like postnatal depression and she's possibly got some other issues. But what is in her past is a sort of slightly exciting way of living. She's been to Paris, or so she says, and she's met Edith Piaf and people like that.
And she reads Simone de Beauvoir.
That's right.
She reads. Linda, the idea of feminism.
That's right. Yeah. Yes, and so so she's quite a big influence in that way, and she sort of, if you like, reflects what's going on in the time. In the changes that are happening in society, whereas Linda and Sandra's are just sort of trudging through and, you know, wearing the clothes and listening to the music and not really conscious of what world it is they're living in, whereas Sylvie has a sense that of where she is and who she is and what has happened and what is happening. She's able to teach Linda that there's a wider world out there.
That's what she does. She's like a catalyst to Linda to kind of open her mind, isn't she?
That's right, yes. I mean, there wasn't actually a Sylvie in the on our estate. She is a complete character that I made up. But I wanted there to be an older woman who was thinking about those issues, because I think for girls at that time, before the women's movement really hit home, there wasn't a great sense of
Who were the role models? Who were they?
Well, in my family, of course, it was my dad, because of his trade union work, but then also my mum, because of the fact that she did have this very Christian moral perspective that you loved everybody, but you did also have a sense of what was going on in the world. So she was very big into the campaign for nuclear disarmament banned the bomb.
Mm-hmm.
CND, and went on the marches, as did we when we were old enough.
So were you, did you remember your mum going off and things?
Yeah, I mean,
were you aware of what it was?
Oh yes, because we had the books. We had books in our house, and you know, I read all about Hiroshima. I read about South Africa, so I knew.
How old were you then when you were reading?
8, 9, 10. Wow. You know, we had the books. Well, the books, books were on our bookshelf. You know, I mean, along with reading Millie Molly Mandy and The Secret Seven. You know,
were you an unusual? You must have been an unusual household. Do you think?
Probably. I mean, we didn't think that. But we did have, I mean, we had books everywhere.
Exactly.
There were books.
I mean, so many, I mean, I didn't, well, no books on in my, I didn't have a bookshelf because, you know, I didn't think I was clever enough, you know, or something.
Yeah. But I was just, actually, as I was coming in on the bus, I was suddenly remembering, and maybe this was, you know, this was part of where my politics started, because my all my mum's sisters were quite radical and quite, you know,
were
political.
They?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
My, so that was the war that did it to them?
Maybe, but they were all bright and sparky, and they weren't. Their dad hadn't allowed them to go on to further education, and you know.
Yeah.
But my auntie Sheila bought me a book called In Came Horace, and it was a story about a cat. Horace was the cat. We had a cat called Horace. That's, I think, that's why she bought it for me. But the story was that there was this little old lady living on her own, and all her friends and neighbours kept saying, "You ought to have a dog to protect you." And she was living on her own with her cat. And they were saying, no, cat's not good enough. You've got to have a dog. You need a dog because dogs are the things that can protect you. And so the story is a series of dogs are introduced into the households. You know, it starts with a poodle and then it goes on to, I don't know, a retriever, and then it goes on to a Great Dane. Mm-hmm. But every time they come in came Horace. And Horace hisses and, you know, and flashes his claws, and out they run. And I, maybe that's the thing that I thought, you know, that the undercat can win when everybody thinks it's going to be the other people who are going to win, the boys are going to win, but sometimes the girls win. Maybe that's what I thought, I don't know. But anyway, I loved that book. I can see it now. It had hardback covers, and it was kind of a red and white cover, and a drawing of this cat Horace with a tail in the air. So we were quite a political family. Yeah.
How did you get to university then, and who encouraged you?
Oh, that was my dad. My mum didn't really want us to go to university.
She didn't want you to leave home, probably.
No. That didn't worry her. What she wanted, what my mum wanted. Mm. Because we had no money, you know, she was hoping we'd get out.
Yeah, and get a job, bring some money in.
Yes.
Yeah.
She did think that I might become a dancer with Pan's People on Top of the Pops.
Oh. That was, you know, that was her aspiration.
Her aspiration. Well, yeah. I think it was probably because I just, you know, in those days.
Were you good at dancing?
Well, you just dance
did
all
you
the
have
time.
Hot pants?
No, I did never had. No, that was. That's slightly after my time, actually, fortunately. You were always dancing, and certainly with mods, there was always, dancing, different dances to be learnt, with Ready, Steady, Go being on the telly every Friday evening, and you'd watch the dances, you'd practice the dances, so we were always dancing. But I think my dad just assumed that we would go to university.
How fantastic.
He just assumed it. I wasn't sure that I would get there, and in fact, I applied for teacher training college just in case I didn't get the A levels. But I did get the A levels. So,
was it harder to get in being a woman then?
See, I don't know, because it. I mean, the statistics I think tell us it probably was, but for all sorts of reasons. I suppose probably because girls thought perhaps I should go to teacher training college or that's it. I mean, a lot of my friends did that. And also
become a mother or go and work in the factory.
Well, then it wasn't worth educating you because you would become a mother because you would leave when you got married. You know, so there are all sorts of reasons. But my dad just thought we would, you know, and that was all. And in fact, you know, my friend Christine thought I would because that was her big thing to me, that I would one day leave Chelmsford. And I would marry someone who wore glasses, because that's...
Did that happen?
Well, almost. Certainly a lot of glasses around, anyway. But no, that was the
thing. So were you different? I mean, okay, your household's different in the way that you, CND, you know, you're political, your dad's got a different job, to, you know, your mum's a caring person. But did you, sorry, I lost my throat. God, I'm not very good today. I don't know what's wrong. Were you different to other people in your class? Were you the one that was more bookish, more, you know, better at studying, you know?
Well, not in my class at school, no, because I mean, at school I was a working class girl from a council estate, and I was at the local grammar school for girls.
So you got into the grammar?
Yeah, I passed the 11th
class.
Passed
the 11th class, which is good, but you again were different because they were all from nice middle class homes.
I mean, yes, because at my primary school, which was a little village school, I mean, I think my sister and my brother and I. Well, because we came from the estate, we, you know, the council estate, we were slightly different because, you know, a lot of the other children were from the farms. You know, their parents worked on the farms.
Did your parents choose that school because it was a nicer one? Or?
My dad did. Yeah, my dad wanted us to go to a village school because there was another school on near our estate that a lot
Everyone
of children
else
went
to.
And in fact, I think had a better reputation. Our school didn't have any kind of reputation. It was just, it was a village school, and my dad had the idea that that would be good. And I think that's right. You know, it was a, you know, I had a lovely time there. I was top of the class. And then I got to the high school and, ooh, no, I wasn't top of the class anymore.
So were the girls friendly or were they snobby?
It was hard.
Did you know that you were different or did they know you were different?
Both, I think. I didn't like it at all at first. I found it very, very hard. I mean, as the years went by, it got easier. But then, in fact, I left at the end of the fifth year and went to a tech college to do my A-levels because I thought that was a more radical, exciting thing to do.
But you got the A-levels and you got to Birmingham, which is brilliant. Mm. And what did you study in Birmingham?
Well, I started off studying politics and social science. And then being a person who's... on many levels superficial, I decided that the degree that I would get if I carried on doing that would be a BSoc Sci. Well, I didn't decide that. That was what you got. You'd got a, if I got my degree there, I'd have got a BSoc Sci. And I didn't want a BSoc Sci because I thought, who ever gets a BSoc Sci? Nobody knows what a BSoc Sci is.
Yeah, I didn't know what you're talking
about. Well,
exactly.
Bachelor of Social Science. Okay. Please. No, I didn't want that. So I transferred to philosophy. So I did a philosophy degree. I finished up doing that.
So you got your degree, and then Women's Aid. How did you get into Women's Aid? Did you go there, you know, how did you end up working there?
Well, when I left Birmingham, I actually went to Leicester and did a teacher training course, because actually philosophy is not a terribly marketable skill. So I taught in Leicester for a year. Then I went and lived in France and taught in France for a year. I know it was, I know. And that was because where the school I was teaching in Leicester, before I went, we had a French assistante, and I sort of said to her rather dramatically, oh, I've always wanted to live and work in France. And so she said, really? And I said, yes. And she said, well, I'll see if my mum can get you a job. And so her mum got me a job teaching English as a foreign language in Tours in France. And so we shared a flat, Dominique and I shared a flat for a year in Tours. And then I came back to Leicester, and then I was teaching English as a foreign language. But while I'd been in Tours, two things had happened. First of all, there'd been a whole abortion debate, and there was
abortion still illegal then?
Yes, it was. And there was a film that had been made that was called L'Histoire d'Art. The story of A, because there had been L'Histoire d'O, which was an erotic novel, and everybody knew it. So
the story of O.
Yes. So this was L'Histoire d'A, and it was a film about abortion, and it was banned, and it was circulating around France, and you'd go to a sort of a community centre or a schoolroom or somewhere, and the film would be shown, and it was all cloak and dagger. And that's what happened to us. We were watching it, and suddenly it all went dark, because the riot police were outside, and they came in, and we were all thrown out by them, and
And it was the first day of my period, and I was having the most terrible stomach pain. So it couldn't have been worse. It was a freezing cold day. It was freezing cold in the room. I had these terrible period pains. And then the bloody riot squad arrived. You think, how much worse can this day get? But anyway, I was outraged. I was just outraged by it all, actually, that, you know, there was this, you know, that abortion was illegal for women, that the riot squad had been called in, that this film had been banned, all of it. And it just, I actually wrote an article and sent it to The Guardian. It was never printed.
You were terribly angry, incensed. You went back, so did you go back to England?
I went back to England, but I'd also read about Erin Pitsey and Chiswick Women's Aid, and I thought, that sounds very interesting. It has to be said as well that at the time, my sister was a feminist, and she was encouraging me to...
She's older.
She's old, two years older than me. She was encouraging me to call myself a feminist, to become a feminist. And
did you know anyone that's a feminist? Was it a strange thing? Was it an unusual thing to be then?
It wasn't a regular thing to be. I didn't know really what a feminist was. I thought it was all about consciousness raising, and I thought that was a waste of time. I thought everyone's sitting around talking about, you know, who they were and everything. And so I didn't want to be a feminist. But when I got back and to Leicester after I'd been in France, I was teaching at a college, and a bloke there told me one day that his girlfriend was going to a meeting that evening. It was a women's liberation meeting, and that he knew I was interested in women's aid. And he said they were going to be talking about women's aid. So I thought, okay, I'll go to that meeting. So I went to the meeting. And, of course, I thought it was wonderful. There were all these wonderful women, and they were all, you know, really full of energy and wanted to change the world. And I signed up for all these different groups, you know, suddenly. But anyway, I became involved with Leicester Women's Aid. And then as a result of that, a job came up in the National Office in London, and I applied for it, and I got it, and that's when I came down to London to work in the National Office as a national coordinator. And it was during my time at Women's Aid that the Domestic Violence and Matrimonial Proceedings Act of 1976 was born, and that was through a private members' bill by Joe Richardson, who was the Labour MP for Barking, I think. And we worked with her, and we gave her evidence and so on. And that was terribly interesting. And I didn't realise quite how dramatically fabulous it was as a piece of legislation.
Well, what did it do?
Because it allowed women, both married and unmarried, which is extraordinary, to go to court to get an injunction in private. And also, if there'd been actual bodily harm, they could get the power of arrest, and it had never been possible to attach the power of arrest to a civil injunction, and this was a real breakthrough. Anyway, it was, you know, it went through. It was marvellous, and then my time at Women's Aid came to an end because we were at that stage, you only worked for about a year or 18 months, and I had to make a decision about what I wanted to do afterwards, and I thought, I don't want to go back to teaching. I could have been a social worker, but I didn't want to be a social worker.
Wasn't enough. You couldn't change enough, could you?
That's probably right.
That was your thing. You were fired up. I want to change things.
Well, I want to work for women. I want to do something that's good for women. So I decided to become a barrister.
Did you know what a barrister was?
Not really, but I knew that barristers did a lot of talking and that they didn't do a lot of paperwork. And that's what I wanted to avoid. I didn't want to do all the paperwork. I knew that that's what solicitors did, because we'd worked with solicitors during my time as a national coordinator, because we'd had, we'd had to assist with the drafting of the bill and what was required and so on. So a lot of solicitors were involved. And I knew, that a barrister had a bit more flexibility. Plus, a barrister wore black clothes, and I had a lot of black clothes. So I just thought it was a perfect match. But I had also, of course, the other thing you have to remember is my dad had been a JP when we were growing up. A justice of the peace, a magistrate in the magistrate's court, and as well as that, a few of the people in Chelsea that I knew were occasionally involved with the police and would, for example, have to go to would have to appear in the magistrates' court, you know, charged with minor offences. And we often would go and sort of sit at the back of the court.
So you had an idea of this world. It wasn't completely alien.
Exactly, exactly.
So how the hell does one look? You know, where did you go? What did you do?
Your
degree already, did that help?
What you have to do is a conversion course. So you have to convert your degree into a law degree. So you do a one-year course where you kind of mug up on all the law. And I mean, that was great, except I think, you know, you miss out a bit on some of the sort of the more philosophical aspects of the law, which you would do.
You had just done philosophy.
That's true, it's true. But you hadn't done the philosophy of the law, which would have been interesting.
And then you
go to the Inns of Court School of Law. Well, we did in those days. It's a bit different now. But you do your vocational course, which is all about drafting and preparing papers and so on. And then you start your pupillage. But while I was doing my training to raise money, money in different ways. I cut people's hair because in the 60s I had been to Vidal Sassoon's a few times. I mean, just for them to cut my hair. And so I did a sort of sub Vidal Sassoon cut for people. And they would pay me because they all wanted me to succeed. Lots of my friends, you know, which was great.
Crowdfunding,
you know, kind of thing. But I also did some teaching. And I taught at Bermondsey Bacon School, which was in fact the school that Tommy Steele went to.
RadioGorgeous.com.
Now, what is your obsession with Tommy Steele? And can you tell us a bit about him? Because obviously I know him as a cheeky chappy, but I don't know much more.
Well, in the 50s, before Tommy the Toreador and Little White Bull, which is what a lot of people think of when they think of Tommy Steele, he was a rock and roll artist. And
he was quite cool.
He was. And he made a few films. He made a film called The Duke Wore Jeans. And I think he also made a film called The Tommy Steele Story. But he started just around the corner from here at the Two Eyes.
Was that on Wardour Street? No, it was on Old Compton. I think
you might be right. Yes, I can't remember.
Two Eyes Espresso Bar.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, as did Cliff Richard and sort of quite a few people. When we were kids and we played games and you had to choose to be a character or something, I would always choose Tommy Steele and Christine would always choose Adam Faith or Yul Brynner for some reason. And her sister Kate, who used to play with us, always chose Cliff Richard. But anyway, teaching at Bacon School was interesting, but it underlined for me the fact that I didn't really want to go back to teaching. I mean, teaching, I love teaching, but keeping children sitting quietly, you know, in their seats is a whole other thing. Discipline was not my forte, and sometimes, you know, you'd be in court, like when I was representing the Greenham women, because that happened soon after I started. We were in court, in the magistrates' court in Newbury, representing the Greenham women who'd been demonstrating at the outside Greenham Air Base, which was an American air base at the time, because the proposal was to bring nuclear missiles into the UK, and they were protesting against that.
And they lived there, didn't they?
They lived there. They camped, and because there were lots of different gates, and so there were different. They gave the gates different colours. They gave them names, and the names were colours: yellow gate, blue gate. And yeah, they set up tents, but then the tents were taken down. They were told that was not legal. So then they started making what they called benders, which is sheets of plastic over bent pieces of wood, and so that word came into the British vocabulary.
Oh, I didn't know, because I know the word bender. I didn't know it was from the Indian.
But sometimes, you know, you'd be in court, and a judge would get very frustrated with you know, either the women or whoever your clients might be, and sort of shout and tell people to be quiet, and you think, you don't know, you're born, you know. You wait till you have to teach a class of 30 kids on a Wednesday afternoon when they've just had games. then you can start getting cross because people won't be quiet, you know. But anyway, so that was it. So after I'd passed my exams, I did pupillage with a barrister called Stephen Sedley, and then I became a member of a set called Wellington Street Chambers, which was quite a radical set, and that was in Covent Garden.
What was radical about it?
The cases we fought, the way we organised ourselves, we were a collective. We pooled our finances. Everybody was paid the same. I'm not sure if I'm even allowed to talk about that now, even now, actually. So that's I'm a bit... But we were radical because of the cases that we did.
You took on things no one else would have.
Well, we did.
Also, you kind of... Yeah, you questioned authority, I suppose, more than other people.
And it was the way we did the cases, I think. The questions that we asked, the way we put a case, raising issues that would normally not have been raised. I mean, I was doing in those days, I was doing crime and I was doing family, as well as some employment and so on. And I know that a High Court judge said to me a few years ago, "Oh, I remember when you used to come and do cases in our courts. We used to travel all over the country in those days." And the way you represented your clients, you and the other people from your chambers, it changed the way we looked at our cases. It changed the way that we as a local authority, he'd been working for the local authority, representing the local authority in care cases when children were being taken into care. And it changed the way they thought about their cases and the way they thought about the parents and what they thought was wrong or not, you know, or what they could overlook.
Yes, which just think the whole of society overlooked everything then, pretty much, didn't they?
Well, yes, although some things they didn't overlook. So, you know, sometimes children were taken into care almost because the house was untidy, you know, I mean, or dusty or something. And you think, God, you might come to my house and, you know.
Yeah, so the priorities were wrong.
Yeah, so people were, you know.
So do you believe, even though, I don't know, it's probably men and women at these chambers, but do you think that you kind of added a femininity, a kind of women's way of looking at things to your cases? Is that what was original about you?
I think the ethos was one of, you know, making sure that women's issues were raised and not overlooked, as with issues of race and also in relation to gay issues. We would always want to, you know, I mean, it goes back to my beginnings, you know, where everybody's equal, everybody's got to have the same rights, you know, and you've got to think about it that way. I mean, I think some people thought that more than others, you know. I can't say we were a perfect set of chambers because the bar is made up of, and was made up of, white, middle class, men. And so, you know, there was a lot of education that had to go on. But I think, you know, they were trying and, you know, we helped them. We supported them, you know. But no, I mean, it was a good time to be a barrister in the 80s, which is when I started, you know, because there were lots of things going on that we, you know, that were issues around the police and interviewing techniques and how people were interviewed when they got to a police station. And there were lots of issues around lesbian parenting, gay custody rights, as well as the issues of the specific issues like anti-apartheid issues, because there were there was the demonstration outside the South African embassy. It was a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week demo, and people were forever getting arrested, and you know we were forever representing them. And then there were the Greenham cases, and then of course there was the miners' strike, and so we were called into. I mean, a lot of the work we did in those days was pro bono because you know people couldn't get legal aid. So we did
in
it
a way
free.
Though you were, I mean, it's everything you're talking about, it's sort of, it's kind of laid, it's what, where we are now, do you know what I mean? And that's why the world's about to change again. It's like, in a way, you really made society a kind of more liberal, fairer place, and now it's such a terrifying idea that it might be reversed in some way.
Well, of course, we did think we were on just sort of on a curve, you know, that we're just that was just going to keep improving, yeah. and you know, things yeah. were going to things yeah. can only get better, yeah. as I yes. think Neil yes. Kinnock said, yeah. With rather disastrous results, yeah. and perhaps we should have learnt something then. But actually, yeah, you thought that's you know we've sorted that out. You know, notions of equality of men and women, that's fine. You know, got that sorted. I mean, it's not perfect, but we know where we're going. Things like that. And now, yes, we find ourselves in a situation where we've almost gone backwards. And of course, for a lot of people, it's because although they went along with it, they didn't really, well, they either hadn't thought about it or didn't care enough to think about it. But now, some of their anxieties or concerns have been tapped into and have been, you know, writ large in the political arena. And, yeah, we've got to be very careful now. We've got to work hard to make sure we don't go back any further. But it's worrying, worrying times.
It is. It's very scary. But let's go back to more jolly things and your book. Who have you written this book for? Who do you think would enjoy it?
Well, Christine likes it. I've written it for people who were there in the 60s. And because what I've always felt, and I mean, the reason I started writing about the 60s was, you know, nobody really wrote about mod girls. And, I mean, they didn't really write about mod boys. They didn't really write about that working class culture. There's Quadrophenia.
Yes.
And, you know, and people still love The Who. But there's not a lot of, well, so-called, I'll put quotes, literature about that time. I mean, there are some books. I mean, in fact, you know, lots of people, now that my book's out, people are getting in touch with me and saying, well, have you read this? Have you seen that? But actually, it's not a lot of novels, and certainly not written from a girl's point of view. And I think I just wanted to write something so that people who'd been there, or even if they hadn't been there, but who were interested, would have something, a good story that would take them into those days, would take them into the Corn Exchange, to the dances, you know, to see Georgie Fame, would take them into the coffee bar and what it was like when you know, the first notes of high heel sneakers came through the room and what it felt like to put on your new suede coat and feel that you were at the absolute bee's knees. So I wrote it for all those people. So it, yeah, it's for people who were there. It's for people who weren't there, and that's pretty much everybody, actually, isn't it? Well, I guess, and people who, you know, I mean, because there's stories of young love and, you know, the feeling uncertain, but also having a good friend. People who, you know, people who had a friend and they remember their friend.
Really,
all of those, yeah.
So what message have you got out for young women out there who are aged 16 or 18 and unsure about life? You know, you've lived it, you've done amazing things. What's your advice?
I'm going to think about this for a minute. What would I say? Well, go for it. I mean, I think go for it is whatever it is, just go for it. And don't be put off. Don't let other people tell you that your dreams are not important or not realistic. I think I'd just say, you know, dare to dream, think about it, but also enjoy yourself. Enjoy, because it's a hard time sometimes being 16, and you know, people can be quite cruel around you, and you know, I can remember I think I must have been 17 or something, and I came up to London. I bought a pair of sailor's trousers from Lawrence Corner, which was an army surplus place on the corner of Tottenham Court Road, or near there. And I thought I was, you know, I thought I was the height of cool, walking around Chelmsford in these sailor's trousers. And they were gorgeous. I mean, you know, when you think about them now.
High-waisted with flares.
That's right, high-waisted with flares. And they had the buttons on each side, actually, that sort of flap.
Kind of 40s look.
That's right, absolutely. But, ooh, you know, I got lots of...
Who do you think you are? What are you wearing?
Exactly, what's that? You know, because the other thing was that, that's right, granddad shirts were coming in. And I think I bought... one or two and I dyed them and I got such, you know, a ribbing for that. But if you can, you know, just think about those people and think they don't know what they're talking about and just carry on. I think, and then, I mean, I have to say my life was never planned. I didn't plan to become a lawyer. I didn't plan, you know, as I say, my mum thought I'd be a dancer. I did think when I left Women's Aid, I had thought about becoming a mime artist, actually, because when I was doing my A-levels, Marcel Marceau was very big, and I had thought, oh, I wouldn't mind doing mime, and, well, as you know, David Bowie followed the same path. Mm. But fortunately, since what I do like is talking, you know, I didn't become a mime. Yeah, I went somewhere where you had to do a lot of talking. I went into court.
Thank you so much for coming onto Radio Gorgeous. Beyond the Beehive is published by Ladder Press. Thank you so much, Elizabeth.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Is a Radio Gorgeous production for Radio Gorgeous 2017. For more information, go to radiogorgeous.com.